From KCRW, this is Greater LA. It's the show that connects you to the people, the places, and the power plants of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiatakis. If you're flying through LAX or biking on Dockweiler Beach, you've probably seen the big, bright red and white tower on the sand. It's as tall as a skyscraper. It's part of Scattergood, one of LADWP's gas-powered plants. And today's story is about this giant hole in the plant right next to the tower and what the city is planning to do with it.
And at the time we said, well, if we're, you know, why are we going to rebuild a unit that would be totally dependent on natural gas when we are planning to be 100% clean energy in the future?
Jason Rondeau with LADWP is pointing to this hole. It's big enough to fit a giant Macy's department store inside of it. A gas plant unit used to sit here until it was demolished a few years ago. Now the city's going to turn this methane gas plant into a hydrogen plant, all part of the city's goal to run on 100% renewable energy by the year 2035.
We want to do this in a way that is affordable, that is equitable, and that is ultimately decarbonizing and improving local air quality.
It might sound great, but it's actually a controversial move. Some residents nearby, and even some environmental groups, aren't quite on board. More now on Why from KCRW's Kaylee Wells.
The Scattergood power plant is a testament to LA's adaptation. The oldest units in the middle of the plant were built in the 50s and take 12 hours to fully turn on. The units behind it were built in 2015. They're cleaner, and they turn on in 10 minutes. Decades ago, it used to run all the time. But these days, with so much energy coming from solar and wind, the plant's usually not turned on at all.
Over the course of the year, we use it about 20 or 30% of the time, more often than not during the summer. In the future, we estimate that we'll probably use it between 1 and 5% of the time, meaning it's rarely used, but when it's used, it's needed.
Scattergood is mainly used for backup. In an emergency like a major heat wave, a wildfire, or an earthquake, we need something that can turn on with the flip of a switch. Right now, natural gas does that. But now the plant is adapting again to get the city completely off fossil fuels.
Based on what we know today, the way to provide that renewable emergency backup power is with green hydrogen.
The plan is pretty simple. Instead of heating up methane gas to create electricity, as it has done for the past 70 years, the plant will heat up hydrogen. Louis Ting is LADWP's Director of Power System Engineering.
Combustion is just like any combustion as far as hydrogen goes, but we got to remember that hydrogen doesn't have any carbon in it. So that's the beauty of it.
The other beauty of it, this is green hydrogen, meaning the hydrogen is created by clean sources like wind and solar energy. But carbon-free doesn't mean it's completely safe for people living nearby. Alex Jassett is part of a group called Physicians for Social Responsibility, which is all about protecting the public from environmental harm.
What we're concerned about is the combustion of hydrogen, because that's where sort of the NOx emissions come from. It's where a lot of the explosion and risks come from. It's where the pipelines come from.
Even if burning hydrogen gas doesn't warm the planet like methane does, it creates nitrogen oxides, or NOx, better known as one of the notorious ingredients in smog. LADWP says, sure, but power plants are not the main cause of unhealthy smog.
Power plants have very, very controlled NOx emissions, and they'll be reduced.
Rondeau says LADWP plants make up about 1% of NOx emissions here. By 2035, they estimate it'll be 0.1%. And the smog problem is better solved by taking gas cars off the road or talking to their neighbor up the road.
That's very different from the airport across the street where, the jets coming in and out have uncontrolled NOx.
Another big concern? Leaky pipes. Legal fellow Theo Coretto with the nonprofit Communities for a Better Environment says that's a risk that comes with anything combustible traveling through a pipeline.
It's actually the smallest molecule. It's just two atoms. It's very hard to detect once it does leak. And so we're concerned about the possibility of these leaks forming due to embrittlement and then hydrogen leaking out into our communities and also just highly combustive.
Tiny molecules can fit through smaller leaks, and hydrogen explosions can make bigger booms. Think of the hydrogen-filled Hindenburg balloon that exploded in the 1930s. Ting with LADWP agrees that it's a risk, but we've been using hydrogen for decades. We've gotten good at minimizing that risk. It's why the hydrogen-fueled Toyota Mirai first launched almost a decade ago.
I don't think Toyota will be producing hydrogen vehicles if that is an issue. And they're the one that actually have customers go into a hydrogen fueling station, plug the hydrogen pipeline into a vehicle.
Those Toyotas Ting's talking about use a hydrogen fuel cell instead of combusting hydrogen. It doesn't emit smog. It only emits water. Here's Jasset again.
And we asked, you know, would it be possible for some of the plants, for example, to be fuel cells rather than combustion?
LADWP's counterargument to that one is pretty simple. They don't have that kind of space. It's a 55-acre plant, but remember, right now they're only looking to fill a department store-sized hole at the plant.
It will take pretty much the entire plant's footprint in order to get the same capacity. And there's no guarantee if that fuel cell will work, because the largest fuel cell that the world has, we know of today, is only about 55 megawatts. We need about 340 megawatts at the plant today.
Plus, a giant project like this one costs money, and getting funding for a combustion plant is just easier right now.
As long as there's the opportunities, like the federal funding for hydrogen, that's where the technology is going to be. And now it's going to be pushed forward because of this current funding.
And that's why in February, the LA City Council unanimously approved spending $800 million to turn this hole in the ground into a hydrogen-burning unit here at Scattergood. Jasset says it's been a fast process, and he's frustrated with how it's gone so far.
It was very sort of shocking for us activists who've worked with City Council on tons of issues, who generally have a pretty open door of communication, to feel like all of a sudden there was this topic that was being sort of rushed through that was not really open to criticism or even feedback from community members.
The city's hoping to complete phase one of the project by 2029. Once the hydrogen is online, the plant will keep burning gas, but the end goal is eventually to burn hydrogen entirely and use 100% renewable energy by 2035. For KCRW, I'm Kaylee Wells.
Rain has been good for the drought, but standing water is a literal breeding ground for mosquitoes. How to avoid getting bitten by those annoying pests as spring and summer come at you? That's after this short break.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
More now of Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Anytime I mention that there seem to be no mosquitoes in LA, up until maybe a few years ago, it jostles a hornet's nest of responses. Like some folks say, you're an idiot. Of course mosquitoes have always been here. Yet some folks tell me how nice it used to be when we didn't have mosquitoes. Whatever you're feeling, we have a couple of experts here to talk about those blood-sucking, itch-inducing, disease-carrying bugs and how SoCal's super wet winter is playing into their plans. I just got one there. For the summer. Brian Brown is an entomologist at the Natural History Museum of L.A. County, and Steve Vitrone is Director of Scientific Technical Services for L.A. County Vector Control. Hey, guys.
Hello.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing well. Brian, who's right? The mosquitoes have been here crowd or the there have never been mosquitoes here crowd?
Mosquitoes have been here, but we have new ones now, too, because there are mosquitoes that are more adapted to living in cities that are here now. So they live in just about any kind of little bit of water that's around. You know, they say that they could develop in bottle caps or, you know, some kind of incredibly small amount of water that they need for developing into adults.
Steve, what is it about those extra wet conditions that mosquitoes love so much?
Well, as Brian was talking about, these newer mosquitoes or these invasive species that we've had to contend here with for the past almost 10 years now in Los Angeles. These are container breeders, and they'll take advantage of any container or any source that will hold even the smallest amount of water. They can lay their eggs on the sides of these containers, and even if they dry out, once they re-wet, those eggs can hatch. And really, you know, with these new rains that we've had here recently, This is creating a much bigger problem for us in many of the backyards, which really haven't been a big problem for us in the past.
You just mentioned, though, up until 10 years ago. So you're saying it wasn't, it certainly wasn't as bad as Brian said.
Well, we've always had mosquitoes here. Many of the mosquitoes, particularly the ones that can transmit West Nile virus, for example, those have always been here. But with the arrival and establishment of these invasive species, these Aedes species, Aedes aegypti and Aedes albopictus, for example, these can transmit some very nasty diseases. But again, they prefer these cryptic sources, these small containers holding water, and they can be easily transported. And they're creating a much bigger problem for us in terms of biting pressure for our residents.
Brian, I mean, it was a wet winter for sure, but it hasn't been wet for the past 3-4 years before this year. How did the mosquitoes become larger in quantity when it was so dry?
Well, the mosquitoes that we're talking about here they have several adaptations that make them really good at living in urban areas, even when it's dry in terms of the weather. And so they're largely independent of the rainfall here. So I don't even know. I suppose there's going to be some increase in the numbers of the urban mosquitoes, but it's the wild mosquitoes that are going to really blossom out, I think, this year.
Is that what you think, Steve, over at Vector Control? You think that the wild mosquitoes are the ones that we're keeping an eye on?
Absolutely. I mean, we have debris basins, settling ponds that where we recharge our groundwater that are filling up, and those are going to create some issues for us. But the big ones for us are backyard swimming pools, the unmaintained swimming pools that that may have been dry here in the past that are now full of water, and those can create significant numbers of mosquitoes for us in our neighborhoods.
I mean, what's the county doing to prepare for the season ahead? I mean, you can't go to every swimming pool, can you?
We can't, but we do maintain a database, and we have upwards of 5,000 unmaintained swimming pools currently in our database, and we get reports of new ones almost every day. And what we do is our technicians will go out, they'll respond to that complaint, and they'll assess the swimming pool, and what we recommend is that the pool be pumped out dry. That would be ideal, but in some cases where it can't, we'll do chemical treatments in order to control those mosquito populations that might be breeding in that source.
Talk a little bit about those chemicals. You see the trucks going through, right, spraying things into the air. We see it in a lot of major cities across not only this country but around the world to fend off the mosquito populations. And I wonder what those chemicals are. A lot of people do.
From what you see on TV with the trucks spraying chemicals into the air, that is something that we have the ability to do, but it's not preferred. That type of spraying really is meant to control adult populations. And that's something that we utilize when we're trying to break a transmission cycle. If we detect virus activity in our mosquito populations, and we have, those are associated with human cases in that area, we will definitely utilize those, we call them adulticides, where we're trying to target those adult mosquitoes. The preferred method and the most effective method is to treat those mosquitoes in their immature stages using larvicides. Many of these chemicals are used on organic crops, for example. So in terms of non-target toxicity, these are very, very safe materials to use, and they're also very effective against immature mosquitoes.
Brian, mosquitoes get a lot of hate for obvious reasons, the disease notwithstanding. Are there any benefits to mosquitoes, to having more mosquitoes buzzing around town?
You know, I get that question a lot. What good are mosquitoes? And mosquitoes are just doing what everything else does, including you and I. They're out there trying to gather enough energy in order to reproduce.
I mean, they're food for bats, right? And other insects, yeah. And spiders, right?
They are, but I hate that attribution of what are mosquitoes for as foods for other animals, as if bats are more important than mosquitoes or whatever. We all know that if insects like mosquitoes disappeared, then the world would be in terrible condition. I mean, it wouldn't be able to function without mosquitoes.
I certainly don't want to disparage mosquitoes unnecessarily, but they seem to be, not very nice beings on planet Earth. But then again, there are a lot of not very nice beings that just exist, right?
Right, including us.
including us. Steve, I mean, as far as anyone trying to prepare for mosquito season, well, number one, from what you've seen with the wet winter, what do you do? Obviously get rid of water, right, where it's standing around your home or, you know, in places where you are.
Correct. And what we encourage our residents to do is to be vigilant on their own properties, because we can't be everywhere all the time. If they notice something even as small as a plant saucer, to make sure that they're dumping that water out. They're not leaving any water standing. And also, in terms of protecting themselves against mosquito-transmitted disease, we always recommend long-sleeve, long pants, which may not be the most comfortable in warm weather, but insect repellent is our best line of defense when it comes to protecting ourselves, not only from being bitten, but also, in terms of mosquito-borne disease.
Brian, is there any particular time of day? I mean, we hear that dusk is the time that mosquitoes come out. Is that true for all these varieties?
Well, these new varieties like the Aedes aegypti and Aedes albopictus that have come in, these urban feeders, are active during the day too. So you could just step outside your door. I do sometimes, and I get nailed by one of these mosquitoes right away. So they come, they don't fly around your head and buzz and whine. They just land directly and start biting.
And you still like these things, don't you?
If you could see a mosquito under a microscope, you'd think it's one of the most beautiful things you'd ever seen, believe me or not.
We're not seeing eye to eye here, Brian, but
have you seen them under a microscope?
No, I have not, and I really don't want to. I would see a lot of my blood in that mosquito, and I would be very upset about that. But but that's you would, right? I mean,
no, you would see them covered in scales like little butterflies.
Okay, that sounds prettier.
Yeah.
That sounds prettier. Steve, are they pretty creatures?
They I would have to agree they are very beautiful when you're looking at them under the microscope. Some species more beautiful than others, but
yeah, they don't look great when they're smeared across your head.
That's what I'm saying. Not when they're on your arm and you just smashed it, right?
Right.
Well, time to stock up on the bug spray and the citronella candles, I guess. Brian Brown of the Natural History Museum, Steve Vitrone of LA County Vector Control. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Even more now of Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. You hear a lot of divisive hot button issues here on Greater LA, from politics to climate change to homelessness. Today, you're about to get wrapped up in a particularly thorny culinary issue, burritos. Much like LA's baseball rivalries, cities around our fair state, from San Francisco to San Diego, all lay claim to making a superior style of burrito. And even just here within L.A., burritos of all kinds abound. So where do you fall on the burrito spectrum? And what might it say about you? Recently, the website Eater did a deep dive on the subject. And today we have Mona Holmes, a GLA regular, Eater reporter as well, on hand to help us dig in. Hey, Mona.
Hi, Steve.
I'm totally enveloped by this issue, by the way. See, it's just
good.
I know. I'm sorry. I mean, joking aside, California cities really do take burritos seriously in different styles, right? So break it down a little bit, the major cities and the specialties.
You know, you joke, but this is serious, very serious discussion.
It is.
I mean, oh, my goodness. Okay, people get downright militant when it comes to their city, when it comes to their burritos. So that was the inspiration behind our package. So we enlisted our sister sites to compare regional styles to add some depth and some information about this longtime battle between San Francisco, San Diego, and LA that says we have the best burrito. So there are a lot of hybrids, but I can break down the regional styles in a very general way for now. So San Francisco is best known for its Mission Burrito. I think we've all had it on some trip up to San Francisco. This is pretty much a flour tortilla that's got rice, beans, guacamole, pico de gallo, and your meat of choice. It's a very familiar template. Chipotle uses it to the letter. And then there's San Diego. Now, I have a lot of love for the California burrito because it has French fries in it. You can't really go wrong with that. And then there's LA. I grew up on that wonderful saucy bean and cheese burrito.
All right. So you're getting the Chipotle style in the Bay Area, right? You're getting maybe some potatoes, right? Another starch. in San Diego. And then, of course, the wetter version, right? Beans and cheese here in L.A.
That's a great description. Right?
So, I mean, yes. L.A., I mean, I guess L.A. is this melting pot, Mona, which means we essentially have the burrito styles from all over the world. There's not just one, right?
Yeah, it's evolved a lot. It's evolved and expanded throughout the decades. We essentially started with the aforementioned style that, you know, that I grew up on. But we excel at a lot of things. So a good example is of how burrito culture shifted a ton in 2015 when Salazar opened in Frogtown, and also when downtown LA's Sonora Town arrived on the scene in 2016. Both of those restaurants make an excellent Norteño style burrito, where it always starts with an excellent flour tortilla. It's filled with guiso or a stew that can be anything from chicharrones or shredded chicken, grilled meats. I also love that our fusion burritos are in play, like all over the place, like a sushi burrito, which I love. There's also the local chain Fatima's Grill in Downey. Now, this place incorporates its Lebanese owner cultures with Mexican and Chicano styles. So you can get a dish like a burrito that's filled with chicken shawarma, beef shawarma, any kind of gyro meat with like turnips, pickles, hummus, onions, parsley, and then a little bit of tajin. You know, that wonderful chili lime seasoning. And then in my hometown of Pasadena is the Judge Ito burrito from Burrito Express. Believe it, you know. That's
Judge Ito from the O.J. Simpson trial. Lance Ito.
Correct, yeah. Correct. And, you know, it's essentially L.A. culture in a compact bite with a tortilla.
What do you think, Mona, about, say, an Angelino who claims allegiance to, I don't know, the burrito in San Diego, the one with the French fries, or the Mission burrito that you see in the Bay Area? What, I mean, can people do that, or is it?
I say more power to them.
Is that like wearing a Giants cap in L.A.? That's ooh, right?
Touchy subjects,
right?
Here's how I feel about it. You know, a lot of folks are militant about it, but I say I love all of California, all of it. So, you know, more power to them. I love how experimental San Diego burritos are. In fact, one of our writers, Bill Esparza, who lives in LA, says that San Diego has the state's most prolific burrito culture. So, you know, as far as how I feel about it, any claim is a statewide win. Also, too, it was in San Diego where I found breakfast burritos that use tater tots. You can't lose with tater tots.
That's like that's the food of our childhood, right? Like our collective childhood.
It serves a purpose. They stay crispier than traditional smashed or, you know, just regular potatoes. So, you know, anyone in the state can claim it no matter what city. I mean, there's even a great San Diego inspired spot in Westchester called Acapella Modern Mex, and everyone loves it. You can't go wrong.
Mona Holmes from Eater LA. Talking burritos today, all kinds of burritos. Mona, I am starving right now. Thank you, Mona.
Good. Go get one. Bye.
Time to wrap things up. Oh, no, I can't stop. Tomorrow on this program, Downey, southeast of L.A., has seen a lot of change over the years, from one of the oldest McDonald's to L.A.'s newest McMansion. That's another example of changing neighborhoods all across greater L.A. Our Born and Raised series continues tomorrow right here on GLA. Share what's on your mind, what's going on in your neighborhood, too. Maybe it's something we should explore more deeply. Go to kcrw.com/GLA and grab the podcast, too. While you're there, you can get the podcast wherever you get your podcast. Just search KCRW Greater L.A. We'd love to be in your lineup. Juliana Mayo, Zoe Matthews, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Jay Siebold, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordahl all help put the show together this evening. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for your time. And, of course, your ear. Have a great night.